for communities and promoting authentic and respectful connections worldwide. We'll always work to invest in and improve our systems and search for ways to help our users stay safe, both online and when they connect in real life. We take every report of misconduct seriously and vigilantly remove and block accounts that have violated our rules regarding this behavior, Match Group said in a statement. You say, in fact, Michael, this isn't true.
They do try. I mean, we've got to give them credit. OkCupid worked for years to try and do this. But when you're having your staff gutted, I mean, even Match Group's team, I think they just fired every single investigator nearly a few months ago, actually. There is a brilliant legal team within Match.com, within Match Group, sorry, who deal with all of this, and they've been doing it for longer than me. I mean, most of the people in that legal team have been doing it for 15-20 years now.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I want to end by asking Emily, do you hold out hope in this last 10 seconds for things to be improved?
I'm kind of a cynic. I think people just need to be careful out there. The person you're matching with might not be who they seem.
Okay, Emily, Elena Dugdale, independent investigative reporter Michael Lowry, former OkCupid head of user security. I want to thank you both very much, and we'll link to the report, Rape Under Wraps. That does it for our show. A fond farewell to Hannah Elias, our video fellow. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's nominating committee meeting will be held on Tuesday, February 18th at 6 p.m. This meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website.
Hey there, KBOO listeners. This is Dr. Tony Zimbardi, host of the new show, Radical Romance. Radical Romance is an advice show for folks who are in non-traditional relationships. Either you're in an open relationship or a polyamorous one, this is the show for you. Please call in. It airs every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 10 a.m. Look forward to hearing from you. That's Radical Romance on KBOO Community Radio.
Hello, I don't even know your name, but I'm hoping all the same, this is more than just a simple...
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, 8 warming shelters will stay open in Multnomah County until Saturday morning as Portland starts to thaw out. A federal judge sides with Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield blocking Trump's gender-affirming care order, and Washington state lawmakers consider an update to their medical aid in dying law. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 14th, 2025. I'm Althea Billings. Multnomah County's 8 warming shelters were open all day today and will be open until at least 10 a.m. on Saturday. The warming shelters that continue to be open tonight are Cook Plaza at 19421 Southeast Stark Street in Gresham, the Hollywood Shelter at 1815 Northeast 43rd Avenue in Portland, around the corner from the Hollywood Theater, the Northwest 14th Avenue Shelter at 600 Northwest 14th Avenue in Portland. Folks can also find shelter at Ascension Catholic Church at 743 Southeast 76th Avenue in Portland, and Grand Oak Shelter at 324 Southeast Grand in Portland. There are also shelter beds at Charles Jordan Community Center at 9009 North Foss Avenue in Portland, at Friendly House, that's 1737 Northwest 26th Avenue, and at Bud Clark Commons at 650 Northwest Irving Street. Each shelter is ADA accessible. Pets are welcome at these shelters and transportation is available. TriMet will not turn people away who cannot pay the fare while shelters are open. People can also find out about getting transportation to shelters by calling 211. A total of 709 people sought refuge at the county's 8 emergency warming shelters that were open overnight on Thursday. Multnomah County is asking for community volunteers to help at the emergency shelters. Chair Jessica Vega Peterson also extended her emergency declaration for Multnomah County through at least 4 o'clock tomorrow. She said, quote, "This has been a long, severe weather event that continues to require vigilance and resilience. We've expanded shelters every day this week to meet the need. Our shelters are saving lives. Thank you to every provider, staff member, and neighbor who has come out in bad weather to make sure everyone who needs one has a place to weather this storm. Your continued hard work is needed and appreciated," end quote. Officials say if residents see someone who is not dressed for the conditions, they can call the county non-emergency line and request a welfare check at 503-823-3333. More information about Multnomah County's severe weather response is online at multco.us/cold. A federal judge has sided with Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield, moving to block the Trump administration from withholding funding from medical institutions that provide gender-affirming care. The temporary restraining order will last 14 days, and it applies nationwide. Rayfield's lawsuit argues that Trump's order violates the Fifth Amendment's equal protection guarantee to trans patients. Rayfield said, quote, "It's hard to believe that anyone, especially in a position of power, would try to make it harder for people to get life-saving care just because of their gender identity. Thankfully, today's ruling stops that, and we can continue to fight for the dignity and rights of everyone, no matter who they are," end quote. Washington lawmakers are considering a change to their medical aid in dying law. KBOO's John Giacopi has more on the story.
Medical aid in dying, or MAID, is legal in 10 U.S. states and the District of Columbia. Oregon was the first to adopt the process, and many others have modeled their laws after ours. The legislation consistently has the terminally ill patients make 2 separate requests for lethal medication intended to end their life. Most include built-in waiting periods between when a patient offers their first request for MAID medications and when the legally required second request can be made. In Oregon, this period is 15 days. But Oregon is one of only three states that allow a waiver of that cooling off period in the case that a patient is imminently dying. If a patient is expected to pass away within the 15-day waiting period, their physician can write their prescription the same day the first request was made, if the waiver is granted. Now, the Washington State Legislature is considering House Bill 1876. It's in committee in the Washington House of Representatives. House Bill 1876 exempts a qualified patient from the 7-day waiting period between the first and second requests for life-ending medication. The proposed Washington bill says patients are qualified for this waiver if the patient is not expected to live for 7 days, the patient is not expected to keep their ability to self-administer their medications for 7 days, or the patient is experiencing irremediable pain or suffering that cannot be reasonably managed or significantly alleviated by available treatment. The bill is more liberal than Oregon's law. Oregon only allows a waiver if the patient is expected to die shortly and does not recognize suffering or potential loss of ability to take the made medications as a reason for the waiver. Dr. Charles Blanke, a professor of medicine and an internationally recognized expert in MAID, submitted written testimony to the Washington House, which he shared with KABU. Blanke said, quote, "About 25% of my patients qualify for an exemption to the Oregon waiting period, and it is one of the biggest benefits I have seen as a doctor. These patients are suffering in ways we cannot fix. Some have nerve pain that cannot be controlled, regardless of the dose of morphine given. Some have literally no quality of life. They cannot read, garden, pet their dog, or talk to their family. More than one experienced a horrendous death during the waiting period, before the Oregon exemption," end quote. In Oregon, about 28% of patients seeking MAIDs are granted a waiver of the waiting period.
Thursday morning was the first meeting of Portland City Council's new Climate Resilience and Land Use Committee. Councilors Steve Novick and Angelita Murillo are the co-chairs, and the other councilors on the committee are Candace Avalos, Samir Canal, and Dan Ryan. There's a lot of issues that fall into this committee's purview. Here's an excerpt of how Councilors Novick and Murillo opened the meeting.
Welcome to the first meeting of the Climate Resilience and Land Use Committee. The committee will meet every other Thursday from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. in the weeks the council does not meet. Councilor Marina and I have discussed some initial areas of focus for this committee, and at this point, I think each of us will hold forth on those for a couple of minutes and then invite the rest of you to jump in. One is to advance climate action and emissions reduction. The climate crisis is the greatest crisis that humanity has ever faced. Human beings have survived plagues, wars, dictatorships, but have never lived in the kind of climate that we are creating. So although what we do in Portland is only a small piece of what the world needs to do, if we do not do our part in trying to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, then in my view, we will be complicit in the misery, destruction, and death of millions upon millions upon millions of our fellow human beings for hundreds of years to come. We need to do our part. We need to ensure climate and environmental justice. We need to do our part to ensure that the most vulnerable Portlanders are shielded from the ravages of climate change and are integrated into what we hope will be a newer, greener economy. We need to adopt land use policies that help us address both our housing crisis and the climate crisis, because land use policies significantly influence our greenhouse gas emissions. Fortunately, the kind of policies that address greenhouse gas emissions also help address the housing crisis. And land use policies also address environmental justice. We can make sure that polluting facilities are not concentrated in areas that are already overburdened with pollution. We need to include, as a city, our climate resilience and our general disaster preparedness. We will be talking about the earthquake. We'll be talking about the critical energy infrastructure hub. Councilor Murillo.
Thank you so much, Councilor Novick. I'm really excited that we're here today. I think everything that Councilor Novick said is correct. We are, this committee is going to be handling one of the toughest challenges that the entire world is going to face over the next few years. And I feel very prepared to do that with all of you here as much as we can to stave it off locally. I also want to add that we have the answers from a lot of people that we haven't listened to before. There are local tribes, there are people who have stewarded the land for a long time who can show us the way, a lot of community members, a lot of researchers, a lot of the folks at the city who we have the privilege of hearing from today have researched things and put together policies and ideas and community things that we can do together that are going to actually lead us in the right direction. And I was really struck by, frankly, our equity training yesterday, where we talked about how in the urgency and pace of city government, it's really easy to continuously look inward and only continue to talk to each other. But we have expertise within the community that we can consult. And I'm really looking forward to our next climate committee meeting, where we can have more testimony and more input from the community to hear about what it is that they're looking for us as well. The only thing I would add is that I think we really have a duty with all of the items that we listed here to make sure that we're looking at them through an anti-racist lens, that we're always making sure that we're checking in with communities that are historically excluded. We know that folks in East Portland, particularly in District 1, are going to be the ones first facing climate impacts. We know that it's 10 degrees hotter over there when we have emergencies, and that we need to make sure that we are looking at all of these items through that lens in everything that we do. And I look forward to doing that with everyone here. Thank you.
That was Portland City Councilors Angelita Murillo and Steve Novick speaking about their priorities at the first meeting of the Climate Resilience and Land Use Committee. The committee meets on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month at 9:30 a.m. Their next meeting will be on February 27th. Federal workers tasked with securing elections from foreign interference are placed on leave. Parents' organizations reject dismantling the Department of Education, and the Congressional Black Caucus presses discussions on slavery reparations. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
One of the things that disturbs me the most is that we don't necessarily even know how some of these espionage attacks that have infiltrated our systems have happened. We don't know how to stop them yet.
Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem says America's digital landscape is under attack, yet DHS has put on leave all its workers assigned to secure elections from disinformation and foreign interference. Experts say gutting the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency puts state and local elections at risk. Jurisdictions that rely on federal help with cyber attacks and physical security for election workers. Confirmation hearings for Education Secretary nominee Linda McMahon began Thursday. The former World Wrestling Entertainment executive aims to dismantle the department she wants to lead. Carrie Rodriguez with the National Parents Union warns undermining public school systems would weaken the nation's workforce and especially harm students with disabilities.
These are basic, essential safeguards that ensure every single child, no matter what zip code they have, has access to the education they deserve. And that is something we're going to be playing with.
Only Congress can close a federal department, but President Donald Trump has already directed agencies to find ways tax dollars can better support private and religious schools. Meanwhile, vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been sworn in as the newest Secretary of Health and Human Services. Trump has also fired officials who investigate government wrongdoing and protect whistleblowers. The head of the Office of Government Ethics and chairwoman of the Federal Labor Relations Authority were let go this week. The Republican Trump appointed as interim Manhattan U.S. attorney quit rather than drop a corruption case against New York Mayor Eric Adams. The White House says the prosecution was ended so Adams could help battle illegal immigration. The Denver Public School System is the first to sue the administration over sending immigration agents into schools. Superintendent Alex Marrero says pointless raids have already prevented buses from picking up students.
You're not going to find these criminals, these gang leaders, and these rapists that we hear that is the target sitting crisscross applesauce on the colorful rug.
The White House insists the aggressive steps are necessary. The Congressional Black Caucus has reintroduced a bill to study reparations for slavery and racism. But this comes as federal agencies ban activities related to Black History Month. Congresswoman Summer Lee of Pennsylvania says America can't ignore its history.
Our government, no matter who is in power, has an obligation to right these wrongs, to provide reparations for descendants of enslaved Africans, to eliminate the racial wealth gap, to uplift the Black community.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's KBOO's Black History and Futures Month series presented by Tina Turner Morfitt and the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Then at 7, stick around for Once Upon a Time. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 27 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 43. Today in history, in 2005, YouTube is launched by a group of college students, eventually becoming the largest video sharing website in the world. The quote of the day is from Danish philosopher Soren Kierkegaard, who said, quote, "When one has once fully entered the realm of love, the world, no matter how imperfect, becomes rich and beautiful. It consists solely of opportunities for love." Senator Lisa Murkowski worries about Trump's order to shut down DEI programs. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As the new chair of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska was one of the featured speakers at the National Congress of American Indians winter session in Washington, D.C. this week. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, she encouraged tribes to stand up for their rights.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's worried about President Trump's executive orders to shut down programs that promote diversity, equity, and inclusion. She says the administration must not be allowed to apply these initiatives to tribes.
This is a different category altogether, folks.
Murkowski says this needs to be made clear to the new administration.
The federal government is charged with moral obligations of the highest responsibility and trust towards Native Indian tribes. And it's that trust responsibility that we're talking about here.
Murkowski told the group she's encouraged by a directive from the Interior Department that says the president's DEI initiatives do not override the department's pre-existing legal obligations to tribes. But the senator says she does appreciate the administration's desire to make government more efficient.
But how we achieve it matters.
Murkowski says, above all, the administration needs to follow the law. The senator drew the most reaction from the crowd when she compared the current political climate to boating in the rough seas of Southeast Alaska, when it's not easy to find safe harbor.
I think we got people vomiting off both sides of the boat, and it's just kind of tumultuous now. So,
Murkowski says she's heard that some tribes have had trouble accessing their federal money. She encouraged them to contact her Indian Affairs Committee so it can keep track. The senator also noted that the president's Department of Government Efficiency should look to tribes and their success in using tribal compacts, a self-governance mechanism that has saved the federal government millions of dollars. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Representative Sharice Davids of Kansas and Melanie Stansberry and Teresa Legere Fernandez of New Mexico sent a letter this week to U.S. Secretary of the Interior Doug Burgum, raising concerns about Indian education. In the letter, they outlined their opposition of the president's order, expanding educational freedom and opportunity for families. They're concerned it would dismantle the Bureau of Indian Education. The lawmakers wrote the U.S. government has both trust and treaty responsibilities to provide tribal education services, led by the Bureau of Indian Education under the Department of the Interior. The lawmakers say the BIE administers funds for hundreds of schools and programs, and for Native communities, there are few to no other options. The lawmakers are urging Burgum to engage in tribal consultation and ensure that BIE programs are fully funded. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been sworn in as the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the Indian Health Service. Kennedy has promised to elevate Indian health in the agency. During his confirmation hearing, he committed to addressing Indian health care.
I'm going to bring in a native at the Assistant Secretary level. I'd like to get him actually designated as a Assistant Secretary for the first time in American history. Ensure that all of the decisions that we make in our agency are conscious of their impacts on the First Nations.
In a social media post, the IHS said it looks forward to working with Kennedy with its effort to strengthen healthcare services, expand access, and improve health outcomes for American Indian and Alaska Native communities. The IHS provides health services to more than 2 million American Indians and Alaska Natives in 37 states. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A bill in the New York State Legislature would require K through 12 schools to teach kids about the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. There are concerns about how to teach such a polarizing event, but the bill's sponsor says its goal is to ensure students know the facts about what happened. Edwin J. Vieira reports.
A New York bill would require schools to teach about the January 6th insurrection. The bill calls for all K through 12 students to be taught about the event, with the state determining how best to incorporate the events into history classes. Since 2021, public opinion on the U.S. Capitol attack has dulled because President Donald Trump and his supporters have downplayed it since then. Democratic Assemblymember Charles Levine, the bill's sponsor, says it's important not to whitewash the facts.
The problem with whitewashing history is that students in those states are not going to learn to be the critical thinkers that we really need in order to confront the great dilemmas that will face us in the future.
Though initial polls found people equated the Capitol attack with an attack on democracy, some polls show people approve of Trump's actions that day. Many groups have teaching tools so educators can accurately answer students' questions about January 6th. While the bill is relatively new, it's garnered positive feedback. It's under review by the Assembly's Education Committee. The bill comes several weeks after President Donald Trump pardoned everyone prosecuted for participating in the January 6th attack. Polls show most people disapprove of those pardons. Levine acknowledges one challenge for the bill is finding an impartial way to teach about a politically polarizing event. He says that will be left to the state's education experts.
Those are the members of the Board of Regents in consultation with the state education department to make the determination about what is taught particularly in subject matter. What this bill simply does is add to a list of major subject areas that should be instructed in all public schools.
Along with the Capitol attack, the bill also calls on teachers to educate kids about patriotism, citizenship, civic education and values, America's history with diversity, and religious tolerance. Levine notes one goal of the bill is to ensure kids learn about good and bad parts of history, from slavery and the Holocaust to the Irish potato famine. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
The National Parks Conservation Association is speaking out against a new order from the Trump administration to review all oil, gas, and mining on public lands, including national monuments. Suzanne Potter has more from California.
Groups that fight to protect public lands are criticizing the Trump administration's new review of all oil, gas, and mining on public lands. National monuments in California protect about 4 million acres of land. New U.S. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum has ordered a 15-day internal review of these sites, which conservation groups warn could be a first step toward altering their boundaries to allow fossil fuel and mineral extraction. And yet, Daniel Hart with the National Parks Conservation Association says this would do little to address the energy emergency recently declared by President Donald Trump.
The timeline from starting a lease sale until oil and gas is pumping and then refined and into the markets is a long time. It would not immediately do anything to lower gas prices.
In the past, Carrizo Plain National Monument on the Central Coast has been eyed for oil and gas development. Other national monuments in California whose boundaries could be reevaluated include the two newest, Chuckwalla and Satitla National Monuments, along with 13 others across the state. Hart says these public lands are crucial for wildlife habitat and recreation, and he points out they pump billions of dollars into the outdoor economy.
They protect both natural and cultural resources. They are a great place for our shared histories, but also the public benefit. They support the outdoor recreation economy, especially in rural states.
Across the U.S., 24 million acres of public land are already leased to oil and gas companies for fossil fuel extraction, with over 12 million acres under active drilling. The NPCA says key monuments outside of California that risk losing protections include Devil's Tower in Wyoming and the Dinosaur and Hovensweep National Monuments in Utah. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Sound recordings can lure wildlife to newly restored habitats. Recordings of songs, calls, and chirps can encourage animals to return after a wildfire. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. During a wildfire, many animals survive by fleeing the area. Afterward, restoring the landscape can help set the stage for wildlife to move back in.
We can plant the trees, we can put the nest boxes in, but it's like building the concert hall, but you haven't got your musicians there. So how do we get the species to return?
Elizabeth Snyderzik of Charles Sturt University in Australia says one strategy is to attract animals with sound. By playing recordings of the songs, calls, and chirps they'd expect to hear in the forest.
They might go, there is something good over there, there's some healthy habitat, or that's prey.
The approach has already worked in other ecosystems. For example, at a restored coral reef, researchers played recordings of a healthy seascape.
And oyster larvae went to that site where they were playing the healthy seascape, as opposed to the control site where not much happened at all.
As Snyderzik says, luring species that visit a forest even briefly can help jumpstart ecosystem recovery. For example, bird droppings disperse plant seeds and fertilize soil. So after a disaster, playing the sounds of a healthy forest can help create one.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Advocates for food equity are raising awareness about the climate benefits farmers markets bring to a community. As Suzanne Potter reports, it can be a form of climate action.
Farmers markets are an integral part of the fight against climate change, according to groups that advocate for a more sustainable food system. Farmers markets not only cut down on the miles food has to travel to market, but they make fresh produce more accessible. That encourages a plant-based diet, thus cutting down on consumption of beef, which comes from cows that belch out a huge amount of methane.